Welcome to the North Carolina Reading Service. Today is Friday, April 26th. Your readers are myself, Tina Casagrande, and Doreen Yelton. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired and is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast by visiting our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. This broadcast is generously supported by The Forest at Duke. They can be reached at 1-800-474-0258. We thank them for their contribution. We will begin by reading the USA Today Newsline section, followed by the Money, Sports, and Life sections. At 8:30 p.m., our featured program will be Triangle Bulletin Board. It's now time for our TV listings.
Tonight on ABC, the NFL Draft starts at 7 and goes all night long. On CBS at 8 o'clock, SWAT at 9 o'clock, Fire Country at 10 o'clock, Blue Bloods. On Fox at 8 o'clock, WWE, Friday Night SmackDown, followed by WRAL's 10 p.m. news on Fox 50. On NBC at 8 o'clock, Password with Laverne Cox and Jimmy Fallon. And at 9 o'clock, Dateline, NBC. On ION, there are three episodes of Bull at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, and 10 o'clock. On PBS Tonight at 8, Washington Week with The Atlantic. At 8:30, State Lines. At 9 o'clock, Great Performances. Now Hear This, Old Friends. How Virtuosos Became Maestros and Their Guiding Principles. At 10 o'clock, Art Happens Here with John Lithgow. On MNT at 8 o'clock, Dateline. At 9 o'clock, Chicago PD. And at 10 o'clock, Chicago PD. On the CW at 8 o'clock, Penn and Teller Fool Us. At 9 o'clock, 100 Days to Indy. And at 10, two episodes of National. On A&E, at 8 o'clock is the first of three episodes of The First 48. So there's an episode at 8, 9, and 10. On AMC tonight, a three-star movie, The Green Mile, that stars Tom Hanks, David Morse, and Michael Clark Duncan. On BET tonight at 8 o'clock, two episodes of Pain, another episode of Pain at 9, A.S. Living as Living at 9:30, and Comic View at 10 o'clock. On Disney, there's a movie, Descendants 2, at 8 o'clock that goes until 10, and it's followed by two episodes of Big City Greens. On Discovery, at 8 o'clock, Gold Rush Whitewater. At 9 o'clock, Backyard Gold. And at 10 o'clock, Mysteries, Banished from Bisbee. On ESPN tonight, there's NBA basketball. The Los Angeles Clippers at the Dallas Mavericks. The Western Conference first round game 3. And there's more NBA basketball at 10:30 on ESPN. On Nickelodeon, Sonic the Hedgehog 2 movie with Jim Carrey and Ben Schwartz and James Marsden started at 7. It goes until 9. And then there's a Sonic the Hedgehog 30-minute episode. And then three episodes of Friends. On TNT, there is a hockey game, but it's not our local team. It's the New York Rangers at the Washington Capitals. That starts at 7 and goes all the way till 10. And then there's more hockey on TNT, the Winnipeg Jets at the Colorado Avalanche. And finally, on USA Television, John Wick Chapter 2 started at 7 and goes until 8:30. And then John Wick Chapter 3 Parabellum starts at 8:30 and goes for the rest of the night.
And now to the front page. Weinstein, New York rape conviction overturned. A New York appeals court has overturned Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein's 2020 rape conviction after finding that the trial judge allowed inadmissible testimony. In the 4-3 decision, the New York court ordered a new trial for Weinstein. He will remain in prison due to a 2022 conviction for rape in California, which led to a 16-year sentence. The court ruled that he could be retried in New York for third-degree rape. The case, which helped popularize the Me Too movement and spurred a reckoning in the entertainment industry, began in 2017 and led to a wave of allegations against the 72-year-old movie mogul. The 2020 rape conviction led to a 23-year prison sentence. The appeals court majority said that Judge James Burke incorrectly admitted testimony from women with allegations that were not a part of the case, but rather, quote, irrelevant, prejudicial and untested allegations of prior bad acts. Weinstein's conviction in New York stemmed from the accusations brought by Miriam Mimi Halai and Jessica Mann, but additional accusers also testified about their allegations of sexual misconduct against Weinstein. Burke's, quote, error was exacerbated when the judge ruled that the former Hollywood producer could be cross-examined regarding these allegations and others, which depicted Weinstein in a, quote, prejudicial light, the majority wrote. Quote, under our system of justice, the accused has a right to be held to account only for the crime charged, and thus allegations of prior bad acts may not be admitted against them for the sole purpose of establishing a tendency for criminal acts, the court's majority opinion states. The opinion continues, quote, it is an abuse of judicial discretion to permit untested allegations of nothing more than bad behavior that destroys a defendant's character but sheds no light on their credibility as related to the criminal charges lodged against them. In a biting dissent, the three judges in the minority called the overturn of Weinstein's conviction a, quote, whitewashing of the facts to fit a, quote, he said, she said narrative. Quote, fundamental misunderstandings of sexual violence perpetrated by men known to and with significant power over the women they victimize are on full display in the majority's opinion, the judges write. By ignoring evidence of defendants' manipulation and premeditation, which clouded issues of intent, and by failing to recognize that the jury was entitled to consider Weinstein's previous assaults, this court has continued a disturbing trend of overturning juries' guilty verdicts in cases involving sexual violence, end quote. The dissenting judges said the majority ruling could lead to Molyneux witnesses no longer being used. Molyneux witnesses are intended to establish a pattern of bad acts. Weinstein's representatives did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Quote, today's decision is a major step back in holding those accountable for acts of sexual violence, Douglas H. Wigdor, a lawyer for 8 Weinstein accusers, said in a statement. Quote, courts routinely admit evidence of other uncharged acts where they assist juries in understanding issues concerning the modus operandi or scheme of the defendant. The jury was instructed on the relevance of this testimony, and overturning the verdict is tragic in that it will require the victims to endure yet another trial.
The shadow workforce. This sliver of southeastern New Mexico, dotted with pump jacks and gas wells, helped catapult the U.S. to energy independence 5 years ago. Immigrant workers, including those here illegally, helped make it happen. That has made for an uncomfortable reality here in this proudly conservative county, where immigration has fueled growth. But the politics are deep red, and nearly 80% of voters favored Donald Trump in the last election. Now Trump's twin vows to drill, baby, drill and deport unauthorized immigrants are on a collision course in Lee County. Here, fake work papers can be bought for $250, and oil companies hire workers, knowingly or not, who sneaked across America's borders or overstayed a tourist visa. The complicated reality, experts say, is that today's oil and gas economy is carried on the backs of migrant workers. Carlos Diaz, 50, who is Mexican, is an oil and gas safety inspector in Lee County. He has been deported multiple times, including at least twice during Trump's presidency. He has always come back and found an employer willing to hire him. "We're the most important labor force they have," said Diaz, who asked to be identified by the name for which he isn't known locally. "We're Mexican, we're close by, we're easy for the gringos to hire." A USA Today investigation found that immigrants, including those without authorization, increasingly do the dangerous and difficult jobs that make fracking for oil and gas possible in the United States. Trump has repeatedly argued that sealing the border and deporting unauthorized immigrants is necessary to fight the flow of drugs and reduce crime, and conservative Lee County residents agree. His promise to roll back environmental regulations and red tape is a winning one in a community that lives and dies by the price of a barrel of oil. Even immigrant workers who could end up deported see dollar signs in the former president's promise to energize the industry. "With Trump," Diaz said, "there will definitely be more work in oil. That's what you hear around here." The Permian Basin sprawls over 66 counties in southeastern New Mexico and western Texas. Lee County and its neighbor Eddy County accounted for nearly a third of crude oil and natural gas production in the basin last year. "Getting all that oil and gas out of the ground requires many hands," said Jonathan Senna, a Republican Lee County commissioner who represents a district where the immigrant population has grown rapidly. "There is so much work in Lee County right now that anyone who wants a job could get enough work for 24 hours a day for the next year," he said. As the oil and gas workforce has grown, the percentage of foreign-born workers in the industry has nearly tripled. More than 14% of nearly 600,000 workers in mining, quarrying, and oil and gas in 2023 were foreign-born, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, compared with 5% of roughly 520,000 workers in 2003. Senna calls himself a very conservative Republican and supports Trump, but in a dog-eat-dog presidential campaign year, he has been struggling with his candidate's rhetoric. He knows immigrant workers, including people here illegally, prop up the industry that is the lifeblood of his community. He also knows them personally as constituents, members of his evangelical church, and his neighbors. Where Trump often describes migrants as criminals, Senna said he knows phenomenal workers. "We see good people and people who are helping the economy do well," he said. "We don't have enough workers in our community." As voters look toward November, expectations for immigration reform from either party remain low. A bipartisan border security bill negotiated by three senators, including a Republican, a Democrat, and an independent, failed earlier this year after Trump bashed the proposal. With no legislative solution, immigration remains a flashpoint in the presidential campaign. Meanwhile, a huge gap remains in the U.S. economy between open jobs and workers to hire. Even if every unemployed American took one of the 8.8 million jobs the Labor Department lists as available now in any industry nationwide, more than 2 million positions would be left unfilled. That's why Beyer, the Cato analyst, said any immigration plan going forward ought to respond to U.S. labor needs. A campaign to scare off immigrants at this moment is not going to do anything to increase drilling in the United States, he said. It's going to have the opposite effect. On a recent Saturday, Carlos Diaz steered a Ford F-250 around the back roads of Lee County, tracing the constellations of oil and gas wellheads under a sky heavy with clouds. "Some of us are worried about immigration," he said, thinking about a second Trump presidency. He recalled the first time he got deported during the Trump administration when he was arrested for driving with a suspended license and was picked up by immigration agents. But he shrugged off the risk. He had made it back so many times before. One of these days, he said, he'll go home for good. He daydreams about retiring in Mexico. I want to go back to Mexico to live the rest of my life, to live my old age, he said. But while I can still work, while I'm still strong enough, I'm going to keep working here.
Nursing home staffing gap wider in the South. Few states meet new minimums, but some much worse than others. Nearly all nursing homes in America will have to hire more nurses and aides under a new rule released this week that mandates a minimum level of staffing, although the gap is significantly wider in many southern states. Just 160 skilled nursing facilities out of roughly 14,500 that receive federal payments for care met the new requirements every day last summer, according to the most recent daily time card data available to the public and analyzed by USA Today. Most nursing homes met core components of the new rule on only 3 days out of 92 in the quarter. About half the time, facilities had enough people to provide each resident at least 0.55 hours of care from a registered nurse each day, as the new rules require. About 1 day each week, the facilities could provide each resident 2.45 hours of care from a certified nursing assistant, or CNA, which they must do every day under the new rules. In addition, nursing homes have to provide a total of at least 3.45 hours per resident of daily nurse and aide staffing, as well as have a registered nurse on site 24/7. The USA Today analysis found that many facilities comply with some components of the rule at least part of the time, but it is rare for them to consistently meet all the minimums. It was more common for nursing homes to have enough registered nurses, with most meeting the minimum about half the time. It was less common for facilities to have enough aides on duty, with most only having enough CNAs about one-third of the time. The rules will be phased in over 3 years. The regulation also allows an exemption to the rules for facilities that can prove they are located in an area with a shortage of healthcare workers and have made a good faith effort to hire more nurses and aides. For decades, academic research has shown that staffing levels reliably predict the quality of care in nursing homes and that shortages increase the risk of delayed response to daily needs like toileting and eating, as well as medical emergencies such as falls and strokes. A pivotal federal study from 20 years ago, when most nursing home residents were younger and healthier than today, suggested a minimum of 4.1 hours per resident each day, more than the new rule. These are the first nationwide minimum staffing rules with numeric benchmarks, which supporters have said will make it easier to track and enforce. Regulations have long required, and still do, that skilled nursing facilities have enough nurses and aides with the correct training to meet the needs of every resident's care plan. Some people require more care from a registered nurse for complex medical conditions. Others need more assistance from an aide with daily tasks like getting out of bed or eating. A previous USA Today investigation found, however, that the rule was rarely enforced. Service Employees International Union, a union representing many healthcare professions, had advocated for the new staffing minimums as crucial to reducing burnout and turnover among nurses and aides, in addition to the benefits for the residents they serve. The new rule could result in nursing homes hiring more than 200,000 additional care workers if they can find them. It is more common in several southern states for skilled nursing facilities to operate with fewer nurses and aides than the new rule would require. In Louisiana, nursing homes had, on average, the total minimum staffing on just 3 out of 92 days in the summer quarter last year. The next lowest were Texas with 4 days, Oklahoma at 8, Tennessee with 8, and Georgia with 9. Louisiana, Oklahoma, and Texas had the biggest gap to fill on registered nurse staffing, meeting the new requirement on 6 days, 14 days, and 16 days out of 92. In addition to Puerto Rico, Guam, and Washington, D.C., Three states, on average, had facilities meeting the new standard at least 75 days in the quarter. Alaska at 90, Hawaii at 88, Utah was 79, Maine at 76, and Delaware at 75. Many southern states also fared poorly when comparing current staffing of aides to the new requirements. Out of 92 days, facilities met the CNA requirements on 11 days in Texas, 15 days in Tennessee, and 16 days in Virginia. On the flip side, facilities on average met the requirement on 89 days in Alaska, 81 days in Oregon, and 72 days in North Dakota.
Feds to crack down on polluting power plants with new rules. The Environmental Protection Agency released long-awaited updated power plant standards Thursday, aiming to further reduce air pollution that makes people sick and the greenhouse gases emissions warming the planet. Federal officials said Wednesday that the rules would deliver on the Biden administration's commitment to provide health protections for communities, including those confronted with decades of environmental injustices. Since the start of the administration, President Biden has made it clear that we are committed to the integrated priorities of ensuring U.S. energy security, protecting people from pollution, and fighting the climate crisis, said EPA Administrator Michael Regan. The four new rules will do that by reducing pollution from fossil fuel-fired power plants, protecting communities from pollution, and improving public health, Regan said, all while supporting the long-term reliable supply of the electricity needed to power America forward. The Department of Energy also announced a new rule designed to make the permitting process for building energy transmission infrastructure more efficient and effective, said Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm. What are the new power plant rules? The Environmental Protection Agency said the four new rules include: require all coal-fired power plants that plan to run in the long term and all new natural gas-fired plants to control 90% of their carbon pollution; strengthen and update mercury and toxic air standards for coal-fired power plants; tighten the emissions standard for toxic metals by 67%; and reduce emissions of mercury and other contaminants that are important for children and others who regularly consume fish with high levels of pollutants from power plants; reduce pollutants discharged through wastewater from coal-fired power plants by more than 660 million pounds a year by setting wastewater discharge standards; require the safe management of coal ash placed in areas previously unregulated at the federal level, including at previously used disposal sites. What are the impact of the new rules? They are a big deal, Ben Jealous, executive director of the Sierra Club, told USA Today on Wednesday. They're saying power companies are going to have to do a much better job of being a better neighbor. The bottom line is this will add up to fewer kids having asthma attacks and fewer adults having heart attacks, he said. Millions of people will have cleaner air and cleaner water. Despite the gains, the State of the Air report released by the American Lung Association this week said 131.2 million people across the nation still live in places with failing grades for ozone levels and particle pollution. What's the biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S.? About 30% of carbon dioxide emissions come from electricity. The electricity sector, according to the EPA's website. The largest share, 35%, come from the transportation sector, which generates about 24% of total greenhouse gas emissions in the nation. The EPA reports that burning coal produces more carbon dioxide than natural gas or oil. The EPA announced the launch of a nearly $1 billion grant program funded through the Inflation Reduction Act to replace heavy-duty vehicles with zero-emission vehicles. The program will support projects bringing electric school buses, garbage trucks,
and delivery vans to neighborhoods across America, said John Podesta, a senior advisor to Biden on international climate policy. These announcements are a huge step toward electrifying trucks and buses across the country, especially in communities disproportionately impacted by toxic tailpipe pollution, said Darian Davis, the government affairs advocate for climate and clean energy for the League of Conservation Voters.
Crime on U.S. college campuses trending up. Some parents hire security force for patrol. As students return to college campuses across the United States, so did campus crime, data shows, alarming some parents so much that they hired their own security force. They raised more than $40,000 to hire private security at the University of California at Berkeley, much to the chagrin of campus administrators. Half a dozen unarmed guards patrolled the campus for more than 2 weeks in March, according to Sagar Jathani, a father of two Berkeley sophomores involved in the effort. A month after Jathani dropped off his kids for their freshman year, in October 2022, there was a fatal shooting near their dorm. Quote, "This was a real rude awakening," he told USA Today. Jathani and other parents were concerned that crime across the city of Berkeley seemed on the rise. A February shooting scared some parents, too. No one was injured, and a suspect was reportedly taken into custody. Hiring private security officers didn't sit well with Berkeley administrators. In a statement to USA Today, spokesperson Janet Gilmore said money intended to keep Berkeley students safe would best be spent supporting the school's police force. Quote, "Hiring private security raises a number of concerns, including the training and experience of individuals hired by such firms," Gilmore said. The number of crimes reported by college campuses across the country rebounded to pre-pandemic levels in 2022, government data shows. Crime reported from nearly 6,000 institutions rose about 8% from 2019, even though enrollments dipped during that time frame. The jump in offenses between 2019 and 2022 coincided with students' post-pandemic return en masse to campuses. Compared with year-over-year changes before 2019, the recent jump represents the largest increase since post-secondary institutions that receive federal funding began reporting campus safety statistics. Experts see little reason to worry and say the numbers are largely consistent with what colleges have been experiencing since 2013, according to S. Daniel Carter, president of the consulting firm Safety Advisors for Educational Campuses. Following a steady decline starting around 2006, the number of crimes reported by colleges and universities remained pretty stagnant over the past decade, according to government data. Yet, when foot traffic on and around campuses diminished in 2020 after classes went online during the pandemic, crime dropped precipitously in 2020. In the years since, it has inched up again. The recent increase was mostly driven by a surge in reported motor vehicle theft, which more than doubled from 2019 and accounted for more than a quarter of offenses in 2022. Carter was skeptical of that increase, saying it could be traced to schools changing their reporting requirements to comply with federal law. Quote, "There has been some work done to increase awareness that scooters and golf carts are motor vehicles. That could be a factor," he said. Government data is not yet available for 2023, so these numbers don't account for the turmoil on college campuses in the wake of the Israel-Hamas war. Recent surveys show many Muslim and Jewish students reported feeling unsafe on campus since the October 7 attacks, which prompted massive campus clashes and protests, as well as surges in Islamophobic and anti-Semitic incidents. The reported numbers for 2022 include offenses that occurred on and off campus, including on university properties located elsewhere, offenses that occurred on public property adjacent to campuses, and a small number of offenses reported to institutions by local police. Colleges and universities that receive federal funding must compile statistics about crimes that occur on or near campus under the CLARI Act. The federal law, passed in 1990, was named after 20-year-old Jean Clary, a student whose rape and murder at her dorm at Lehigh University drew national attention. The tension colleges contend with in simultaneously trying to encourage students to report crimes and keep numbers down was on full display during a recent scandal at Liberty University, a private evangelical university in Virginia. The federal government concluded last year that the school created a culture of dissuading victims of sexual assault from reporting what happened to them, according to a preliminary report obtained by USA Today. Then, in March, the Education Department slapped the school with a $14 million fine and ordered officials to pay an additional $2 million for on-campus safety improvements and compliance enhancements. In a written statement in March, Dondi E. Costin, Liberty's president, said the school sincerely regretted the errors. The scandal shed light on the consequences schools face if they don't fully comply with the law, said Abigail Boyer, the associate executive director of the Clary Center, which tracks campus safety trends. Quote, ultimately, we want campuses to create a culture in which students are comfortable about reporting, she said. Clary Act figures are self-reported, and the Department of Education doesn't verify them independently. However, the agency conducts periodic reviews of Clary Act compliance. Over the past 15 years, the agency has evaluated at least 110 universities. Dozens of those cases have led to fines. The Clary Act requires schools to report motor vehicle thefts, but the statute doesn't only include cars. Scooters, electric bicycles, and golf carts fall into the same category. Several schools said the surge in crime on or near their campuses in 2022 could be attributed to the revised reporting of scooter, electric bike, and golf cart theft. In 2022, Grand Canyon University in Arizona began classifying thefts of skateboards, scooters, and bikes under the umbrella of motor vehicle theft. Spokesperson Bob Romantic said the overwhelming majority of the school's additional criminal offenses in 2022 were due to that change. Beyond that, he said, we saw slight increases in some other offenses due mostly to the rapid growth of our campus population, increased crime in the Phoenix area, and the fact that we were still coming out of COVID. David Kelly, spokesperson for the University of Colorado, Denver, and Schutz Medical, said the school has taken steps to combat a jump in motor vehicle thefts, installing more security cameras and deploying officers to monitor parking lots and garages. It could be that there are more of these vehicles on campuses as well, according to Bethany Glover, a spokesperson for the University of Virginia. Quote, the presence of motor scooters on grounds and across the country has increased dramatically, and reports of theft have increased along with them, she said.
Arizona grand jury indicts Trump allies. 11 state Republicans, 7 former aides charged. A grand jury has charged 11 Arizona Republicans and 7 former aides to Donald Trump in a scheme to keep Trump in the White House by falsely certifying he won the state in 2020, appearing to include the former president's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and former chief of staff, Mark Meadows. Attorney General Chris Mays, a Democrat, announced the indictment had been issued on Wednesday. It alleges the slate of Republicans, sometimes known as fake electors, engaged in a conspiracy aimed at preventing the lawful transfer of the presidency of the United States, keeping President Donald J. Trump in office against the will of Arizona voters, and depriving Arizona voters of their right to vote and have their votes counted. Mays has been under immense political pressure to bring a case. Similar slates of electors in Michigan, Georgia, and Nevada have already been charged for their role in the sweeping effort to keep Trump in power. And a federal grand jury last year brought charges against Trump, alleging the former president conspired with others to disenfranchise voters and subvert President Joe Biden's win. Trump is also facing charges in the Georgia case, which alleges he led a criminal enterprise and relies on a state law normally reserved for prosecuting mobsters. Several of the Arizona electors have previously claimed they were merely offering Congress a backup plan, though nothing in the documents they sent to Congress and the National Archives backs up that assertion. Similar groups of electors in other states did include conditional language, but none was included in Arizona. Biden carried Arizona in November 2020 by 10,457 votes. With nearly 3.4 million votes cast, it was Biden's smallest margin of victory in any state and only the second time in 70 years that a Democrat won the state. Arizona actually had two different groups of illegitimate GOP electors. The indictment made public on Wednesday names the slate that included more prominent Republican figures, some of whose involvement has already been well established by the Congressional Committee investigating the violent break-in at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Those 11 GOP electors met at the Arizona Republican headquarters in Phoenix on December 14, 2020, posting videos on social media of themselves casting their votes for Trump. They signed paperwork to submit to Congress, claiming they were duly elected and qualified electors, but that was a lie. The same day, electors for Biden met to cast their votes in the Electoral College, confirming the Democrats' win. They met at an undisclosed location, citing security concerns tied to Trump's refusal to accept his loss. It was a procedural process that, prior to 2020, was a formality often overlooked by most Americans. Mays confirmed more than 1 year ago, in March 2023, that her office would investigate Arizona's electors who falsely claimed to be legitimate. Mays pledged to protect election workers and defend elections, where her Republican predecessor, Mark Brnovich, had tried to straddle election denialism. Two Arizona congressmen who were among the loudest voices in support of Trump's Stop the Steal campaign, Andy Biggs and Paul Gosar, received subpoenas. Mays' office turned to Trump attorney Kenneth Chesbrough for information. Chesbrough, who aided prosecutors in Georgia after he was indicted, and Nevada, wrote memorandums outlining the strategy to send alternate electors to Congress. Sending the documents from Trump electors can prevent Biden from amassing 270 electoral votes on January 6th and force the members of Congress, the media, and the American people to focus on the substantive evidence of illegal election and counting activities in the six contested states. One memo from December 6, 2020 reads, "The memo suggests states that undertook the plan should also spread messaging that presents this as a routine measure. The effort was anything but routine. It was criminal," the grand jury said.
Arizona 1864 abortion ban repeal approved by House. Three Republicans joined Democrats to sway the vote. The Arizona House on Wednesday narrowly voted to repeal a near-total abortion ban dating from 1864, capping 3 weeks of efforts that have galvanized national attention. The 32-28 vote came after passionate speeches from most Republicans, who described abortion in graphic detail and as contrary to Republican values. But their attempts to block the repeal failed when Republicans Matt Gress and Justin Wilmeth of Phoenix and Tim Dunn of Yuma joined with all 29 Democrats to pass House Bill 2677. Quote, "Stop calling it archaic to ban abortions," said Representative Barbara Parker, Republican from Mesa, referring to critics of the near-total abortion ban who constantly note it was enacted 160 years ago. "It's archaic to do abortions." Parker, like many of her fellow Republicans, called abortion murder because it does not respect the life of unborn children. Quote, "I can hear their silent screams, and with my voice, I vote no," Parker Republican from Mesa, said. Aside from the emotional comments, there was little reaction when the vote was finalized. Democrats and the three Republicans were silent as they cast their votes, but anger bubbled over when Gress mentioned that the bill be sent to the Senate and have it returned without amendments so it could be immediately transmitted to Governor Katie Hobbs for her action. That motion failed, but it unleashed an immediate and angry response from Republicans who saw it as unnecessary and divisive. Republican Speaker Pro Tem Travis Grantham said the motion, quote, drives a knife into the House chamber, which has endured three successive weeks of tense and dramatic debate over the law that the state Supreme Court upheld on April 9th. House Speaker Ben Toma immediately removed Gress, as well as Representative Oscar De Los Santos, Democrat from Phoenix, from the Appropriations Committee, a key panel that is pivotal to work on the state budget. The vote turns attention to the state Senate, which is poised to take up the matter next Wednesday if there is agreement to bring it up for a vote. Last week, with little fanfare, the Senate started work on Senate Bill 1734, which is identical to the measure the House approved. Reaction to the House vote was widespread and broke along ideological lines. The Alliance Defending Freedom, which successfully defended the 1864 law before the state Supreme Court, expressed disappointment in a statement. Quote, life is a human right, and it always will be, said senior counsel Jake Warner. This doesn't cease to be true because of a vote. We will continue to do everything we can to protect life and advocate for real support and real health care for women and families in Arizona and across the country. Likewise, Kathy Herod, president of the Anti-Abortion Center for Arizona Policy, was dismayed at the vote. Quote, I weep and I grieve for the lives of unborn children that are lost to abortion and for the lives of women that will be harmed by abortion, Herod said. She was a key advocate for ensuring that the 1864 law would take effect if the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the Roe v. Wade decision, which it did in June 2022. Chris Love, spokesperson for Arizona for Abortion Access Initiative, called the House's vote, quote, too little, too late. That's because the House didn't muster enough votes to pass the repeal on an emergency basis. If this were the case, it would allow the repeal to take effect as soon as Hobbs would sign it. Instead, the 1864 law is set to have the force of law on June 8th, well before HB 2677 is expected to take effect. Initiative backers said they'll press on with their efforts to get the measure on the November 5th ballot and to convince Arizona voters why it's needed. Quote, one thing remains clear, anti-abortion politicians and architects of a scam to confuse voters cannot be trusted to give Arizonans the freedom to make their own deeply personal decisions about abortion, said Cheryl Bruce, campaign manager for Arizona for Abortion Access. Attorney General Mays said in a statement that she was glad, quote, sanity prevailed at the House, and she urged the Senate to act quickly. That 160-year-old law that criminalizes doctors and nurses for caring for their patients and endangers the lives and health of women across our state has no place in the 21st century, Mays said.
Here's an opinion piece by Ingrid Jocks. UNC fails valedictorian's free speech rights. Things are not well on America's college campuses. The disgusting anti-Semitism that seems only to be building and campus administrators' lackluster response has led to some truly frightening displays. Violence and rule-breaking behavior must not be tolerated, period. Yet higher education leaders cannot make an unsettling time an excuse to censor perfectly fine speech just because they fear a difficult situation. That's what happened at the University of Southern California when the Los Angeles school decided last week to cancel valedictorian Asna Tabassum's commencement speech in May, the first time that USC has prevented its top graduate from speaking at the graduation ceremony. College officials claimed they were concerned about the alarming tenor that had taken place on social media after Tabassum was named valedictorian.
The ongoing Israel-Hamas war in Gaza has led to increased tensions in the United States following Hamas's brutal attack against Israel on October 7th. Detractors were displeased about Tabassum's support of Palestinians and accused her of anti-Semitic and anti-Zionist rhetoric. The intensity of feelings fueled by both social media and the ongoing conflict in the Middle East has grown to include many voices outside of USC and has escalated to the point of creating substantial risks relating to security and disruption at commencement, Provost Andrew Guzman said in a statement on April 15th. The decision is not only necessary to maintain the safety of our campus and students, but is consistent with the fundamental legal obligation. Following controversy over the decision to prevent Tabassum from speaking, USC has since doubled down by canceling appearances of other speakers and honorees. Not only is USC's decision an affront to free speech, it also fundamentally is unfair to Tabassum, who undoubtedly worked hard in her years at the university to earn this achievement. She shouldn't have this experience taken from her. In a statement, Tabassum said she is surprised that USC abandoned her. Now Tabassum may well have repugnant personal views, and her speech may stoke division on campus. Even so, her accomplishments should not be undermined because of fears of possible violence and a speech she likely hadn't even written yet. Rather, the university should have committed to keeping her and others attending a graduation safe. And if it knew of a tangible security threat, it should be upfront about that. Meanwhile, administrators at private Adrian College in Michigan are handling their own controversy in much better fashion. They're pretty much ignoring it. Last month, Adrian College announced that Riley Gaines would be its commencement speaker on May 5th. Gaines, who is often described in the media as an anti-trans rights activist, is a lot more than that. She is an accomplished former NCAA competitive swimmer who became well-known after she tied transgender swimmer Leah Thomas in the 200-yard NCAA freestyle championship race in 2022. Following that experience, Gaines has become an outspoken defender of fairness in women's sports and speaks frequently on the issue at universities around the country. Gaines is used to attracting pushback and even violence on campuses, so it's probably no surprise to her that there are factions of the Adrian community who aren't happy that she will speak at the school. A student LGBTQ plus group started an online petition urging the college to disinvite Gaines and now has more than 1,600 signatures, but the college isn't backing down. Adrian College has never shied away from presenting and debating substantive disagreements on campus, Adrian President Jeffrey Docking said in a news release last month. In fact, this is precisely the purpose of universities, to engage in civil discourse of controversial issues. We welcome Riley Gaines to our beautiful campus, and we feel confident our students will be inspired by her commencement address. I hope Docking and fellow administrators stay firm in their commitment. And even though it may be embarrassing for USC to backtrack, it should reinstate valedictorian Tabassum as a speaker at commencement. More than ever, college students need examples of what free expression really looks like. Ingrid Jocks is a columnist at USA Today. You can contact her at ijocks@usatoday.com.
And one more opinion piece, this one from Sarah Pequeño. I found a love for women's sports because of Caitlin Clark. I would never call myself a sports person, and I'm not athletically gifted. I'm too short, too bow-legged, and too awkward. I don't get excited about the Olympics and spent my college years at the University of North Carolina missing basketball games by working instead. I hear they have a good team. Recently, however, my attitude towards sports has changed. Like most good things in my life, that's thanks to women. I'm one of the casual fans who has been swept up in the frenzy over women's basketball, fed in part by Caitlin Clark's ascent to household name. I'm also from the South and felt it was my duty to cheer on the University of South Carolina Lady Gamecocks when my friends and I squeezed into a Brooklyn one-bedroom to watch them win the Women's Basketball National Championship this month. I couldn't tell you the most interesting plays of the game, but I could tell you what I felt watching as South Carolina coach Dawn Staley broke down on camera, surrounded by the team that helped her get a third national title as head coach after an undefeated season. It was the feeling I had been waiting for, the feeling that keeps sports in our collective conscience and keeps fans coming back year after year. This feeling, I think it's called being a fan, has continued into the month as I've watched respective moments from both Clark and Staley. I watched Clark take on Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update host Michael Che for his misogynist jokes at the expense of women athletes, where she took time to uplift other basketball players who paved the way, including the Gamecocks coach. I heard Staley praise Clark, now an Indiana Fever player, for elevating the game and growing viewership numbers. It's actions like that, to me, that make this moment so special. There's a reason why tickets to the women's Final Four games cost more than the men's side. There's a reason that viewership for the women's basketball championship surpassed the men's final with 18.9 million viewers to their 14.8 million. There's a reason you can't go online without seeing Clark's face or hearing mention of the WNBA draft, whose 2023 season also saw a spike in viewership. The reason is Clark, but it doesn't change the fact that the entire sport should have been getting more recognition for years. The fact that women's sports have been treated as secondary to the men's teams for so long is thanks to generations of misogyny. It shouldn't take an uncomfortable comment from a sports journalist or a player opening up about their working conditions for the rest of us to realize that women still aren't receiving the respect they deserve. This lack of support affects game attendance, which in turn affects the working conditions of the players. It's why the United States women's national soccer team had to go to court to earn annual salaries comparable to their male counterparts despite winning 4 World Cups and 4 Olympic gold medals. It's why WNBA players have spoken up about the conditions they travel and play under. And it's why Clark, arguably the most talked about basketball player of the past 2 years, is starting in the league, making a fraction of what the first pick in the men's draft will receive in their first contracts. It is not fair that female professionals in their field are not being paid comparably to men. It shouldn't matter that it's occurring outside of what we consider a, quote, typical profession. We might be experiencing another spike in popularity before the frenzy dies down. Every few seasons, it'll feel like we've made strides in popularizing the wildly inoffensive idea that women's sports deserve the same enthusiasm and fair pay for that enthusiasm the men receive, only for reporters and advertisers to move on after the season ends. We've seen it before with the 2019 Women's World Cup. Women's sports don't have to be a niche community. I'm happy to be here and want others to hop on the bandwagon. These games can be for everyone. They just need the support of the sports media landscape and the advertisers. We've already seen how this can create household names. We only have to look to athletes like Simone Biles, Serena Williams, and Megan Rapinoe. All of them have name recognition because they are both phenomenal players and have become fixtures on our screens thanks to advertising. For me, I hope to keep the momentum going by catching some New York Liberty games in the upcoming season. I hope you look into tickets for your local WNBA team as well. We could all stand to put our money where our mouths are and keep feeding the excitement around women's sports. Everyone deserves to be able to watch a team they care about with people they care about. I've realized it's good for the soul, regardless of what gender is wearing the jersey. And this again from Sarah Pequeño. And now for some announcements. North Carolina Assistive Technology Program Pop-Up Fair. Get active and get outdoors. The North Carolina Assistive Technology Program has been hosting pop-up fairs at various locations throughout the state. Learn about local resources and get hands-on experience with accessible equipment, regardless of your ability, at an adaptive recreation and active living resource fair. Fairs are free and open to the public. We encourage everyone interested in staying active, accessible recreation, and leisure activities to attend. A pop-up fair will be held at the following location. Next Friday on May 3rd from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Charlotte AT Center in Charlotte. The event is free, but registration is required. To register or to learn more about the NCATP Center nearest you, visit their website at www.ncdhhs.gov/NCATP. Accessible Pharmacy Blindness and Mental Health Summit. Accessible Pharmacy, a provider of home-delivered prescription medicines with talking bottles, is hosting the first annual Blindness and Mental Health Summit. This virtual and free summit is the largest online gathering of organizations and consumers sharing information, resources, and services focusing on mental health in the blindness, low vision, and disability communities. The Blindness and Mental Health Summit will be held online Friday, June 14th from noon until 4 p.m. For more information or to register for this free online event, visit the Accessible Pharmacy website at accessiblepharmacy.com. You will find the Blindness and Mental Health Summit under the Events tab. Call for Art Celebration. Arts Access Gallery is excited to host its second exhibition titled A Celebration of the ADA, featuring works of art created by North Carolina artists with disabilities. As they celebrate their 40th anniversary and the Americans with Disabilities Act commemorates its 34th year, they want to know what you celebrate in life. The exhibition will be on view at Arts Access Gallery in downtown Raleigh on June 7th through July 26, 2024. The gallery is located at 444 South Blount Street, Suite 115B in Raleigh, 27601. For more information on the exhibition, please visit the Arts Access website. The full call for art can be found on the Arts Access Gallery page, and the website is artsaccessinc.org/A Celebration of the ADA Group Exhibition Call for Art. Tactile tours available at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Designed for visitors who are blind or have low vision, these docent-led tours explore the museum's collection through audio description, tactile experiences, and by engaging the senses. Tours are by request only and must be scheduled at least 2 weeks in advance. To schedule a tactile tour, please call 919-664-6854 or email Accessibility Coordinator Molly Hull at mhull@ncartmuseum.org. You are listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, connecting people who are blind and print impaired to each other, their families, and communities by delivering news, information, and entertainment using the latest audio technology. In addition to using specially tuned sub-channel radio receivers, NCRS streams our programming on our website, ncreadingservice.org. You can listen by using the Listen Live streaming audio player located at the upper right-hand corner of our website pages. If you have an assisted technology device such as Alexa or Google Home, just say, "Tune in NC Reading Service" to listen instantly. We also provide podcasts of over 50 magazines and other information and entertainment programs following the initial broadcast. Please visit our website, ncreadingservice.org, and click on the Listen tab, and then click on Skip to Podcast section. For more information about the North Carolina Reading Service, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.
From the money section, U.S. economy's growth slower than expected. The U.S. economy slowed more than expected early this year as weaker business stockpiling and exports offset solid consumer spending and a flurry of housing construction. The nation's gross domestic product, the value of all goods and services produced in the U.S., expanded at a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 1.6% in the January to March period, the Commerce Department said Thursday. That's down from robust growth of 4.1% in the second half of last year. But the pullback was caused chiefly by businesses that replenished their inventories more slowly and feeble export growth, two volatile categories that don't reflect the economy's fundamental health. Final sales to private domestic purchasers, which excludes those elements as well as government spending, grew a robust 6.1%. That illustrates there is still a lot of positive underlying momentum, Paul Ashworth, an economist with Capital Economics, wrote in a note to clients. Since late 2022, the economy repeatedly has defied forecasts of a sharp pullback or recession, shrugging off the Federal Reserve's aggressive interest rate hikes and the inflation spike those high rates aimed to tame. Some analysts believe Thursday's weaker-than-expected report signals the start of a broader slowdown in the economy. That trend, along with resumption of a more rapid deceleration in inflation, could allow the Fed to plow ahead with multiple rate decreases, some forecasters say. Ian Shepherdson, chief economist of Pantheon Macroeconomics, acknowledged that last quarter's slowdown in growth can be traced largely to inventories and exports, but he added that consumption is also starting to wobble a bit. Consumer spending, which makes up about 70% of economic activity, has underpinned buoyant growth. Consumption grew a solid 2.5% early this year, following a 3.3% gain in the fourth quarter. The rise, though, was driven by an increase in spending on healthcare and financial services. Purchases of goods, including cars and gasoline, declined. Shepherdson said the 2.5% increase in spending was less than the 3% economists expected and below the recent trend, heralding a sharper drop-off in the months ahead. Americans' ability to open their wallets in recent months has surprised some analysts because pandemic-related savings have largely run out, especially for low- and middle-income households. Credit card debt is at a record level, while delinquencies are historically high. But employers have added a booming average of 276,000 jobs a month this year, while wage growth has moderated, average pay still rose 4.7% annually in March, according to the Atlanta Fed's wage tracker. That's giving many Americans the wherewithal to splurge, especially now that pay increases are outpacing inflation. Shepherdson, though, expects a job growth to slow significantly. It's a close call, but we still see a path to the first Fed rate cut in June. If payroll gains slow substantially and inflation eases, he wrote in a note to clients. Pessimists are becoming harder to find. Before Thursday's report, forecasters estimated GDP would grow a solid 2.4% this year, and they figured the odds of recession had dropped to 30% from 60% last May, according to a survey by Wolters Kluwer Blue Chip Economic Advisors in early April.
And now over to the sports section. Deion's second spring game, much different. Deion Sanders has fashioned a new look for himself this spring as head football coach at Colorado. At age 56, the Pro Football Hall of Famer grew out his light beard and often showed up for work in blue-collar coveralls that otherwise might be worn by a car mechanic. In this case, the style fits his task. Renovations are underway by a repairman who's 1 year wiser and grayer. The question now is if it's all good enough in year two after so much fell apart in year one, especially when it seems his player roster is constantly changing. Is Sanders' quarterback son Shadur really better after breaking his back last season? Are his blockers up for the job this time after Colorado brought in a whole new starting offensive line to replace last year's? And does the Colorado fan base still believe? Some clues will be revealed Saturday at Colorado's annual intra-squad spring game at Folsom Field. The television audience and crowd for the spring game will be much smaller this year than last year, Sanders' first season in Boulder. But it still will likely be the second biggest spring football crowd in Colorado history, better than 2008 when the game drew 17,800 people. There are at least two general reasons for this. Many CU alumni and fans still believe in the high potential of Deion Sanders after he turned around a downtrodden program that finished 1-11 the season before he was hired in late 2022. Quote, I'm hugely optimistic, said Jeff Crawford, a Colorado graduate and donor to CU Athletics. But there are also plenty of reasons to be skeptical after Sanders finished his first season in Boulder with a 4-8 record, including 8 losses in his final 9 games. Much like last year, Colorado's roster is being remade with dozens of transfer players coming and going. Quote, the best teams that I was on weren't the most talented teams, former Colorado and NFL linebacker Chad Brown told USA Today Sports. Talent is only a part of the equation. You've got to get these guys to play together and become a team. So with all the movement in and off of this roster, it just seems like it's an incredibly difficult task to develop players and to grow a culture there. So hopefully that part of it is not being overlooked. Instead of being on ESPN like it was last year, the game will be on the Pac-12 network for 1 hour starting at 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time Saturday, followed by the Oregon Spring Game at 4 p.m. Eastern. Instead of a sellout crowd like last year, 47,000 people, there were 22,000 tickets distributed as of Monday. Both are a far cry from what Deion Sanders wanted. In a video posted this week, he said his team is so much better this spring compared to last year. Quote, night and day, he said on the pregame show. On paper, he's probably right. His star players return, including Shador Sanders and two-way phenom Travis Hunter, both of whom have their replica jerseys on sale in the campus bookstore for $109. Colorado's biggest weakness last year, the offensive line, also appears to be bigger and better. So then, why did Coach Prime have to make this kind of plea to fans this month? Quote, I want everything we do sold out, he said on Well Off Media on April 10th. I didn't stutter, nor did I stumble. I want it sold out. We love you. We love us. Let's get together. Let's make it happen. It likely won't, but that doesn't mean big things aren't happening this weekend for Sanders and Colorado. They are, just with a little more of a wait-and-see market than before. Recruits are coming. Rapper Lil Wayne is performing, and Deion Sanders is helping host a primetime elite dinner on Friday to benefit the collective that supports his players for their names, images, and likenesses. A VIP table with Coach Prime already sold out at $20,543 for 8 tickets. Just like last spring, Sanders will use this weekend to showcase his program for recruits. Among those planning to visit Boulder is Byron Lewis, a high school running back out of Fort Lauderdale, Florida, who ranks 14th nationally as a running back prospect, according to 247 Sports composite rankings. University of Colorado, I'm on my way, Lewis wrote Wednesday on social media site X. Colorado also is expected to host several transfer players who plan to enroll this year, including Pittsburgh defensive end Deion Hayes, Ohio defensive lineman Rayon Buell, and Texas offensive lineman Peyton Kirkland. The latter three show that the transfer portal door swings both ways, in and out. Colorado has had at least 33 scholarship players announce they were transferring or leaving the team since November, mostly backup players or those who became disenchanted with the program, such as Cormani McClain, the number one cornerback recruit in the nation last year. But the Buffs also have added at least 28 transfers since last December, several of whom will play Saturday. Those who make the trip this weekend also can see Lil Wayne, Deion Sanders' friend, who will perform at the CU Event Center on campus after the game Saturday. That concert is nearly sold out, with over 6,000 tickets out as of Monday, according to the university. None of the 5 starting offensive linemen who finished the season last year at Colorado are even on the roster anymore after 4 decided to transfer and another exhausted his eligibility in college. Anywhere else, that probably would not be good. But here at Colorado, fans are excited about it. That's because last year's offensive line gave up the second most quarterback sacks in the nation with 56, leaving Shedeur Sanders battered to the point that he fractured his back. Quote, "Our biggest weakness last year was in the trenches," said Crawford, the CU grad and donor. "I think we have upgraded significantly in the trenches, and I think that will be the difference this year. If those guys play well, like I think we will, I think we'll have a very successful year. It's still a question that won't be answered until the fall. Can this new group block? There are a bunch of new transfer players, along with Jordan Seaton, the number one offensive tackle recruit in the nation for 2024, according to 247 Sports. Quote, "Just to say you've got new offensive linemen doesn't mean you've got a new offensive line," said Brown, the former Colorado linebacker. "The line is the one unit on the football team that requires the most work, that requires the most time together, that requires the most unspoken communications. How do you turn some linemen into an offensive line? That's a very critical piece." Deion Sanders still sees huge progress there nonetheless. Quote, "These guys are a tremendous group and they're a tremendous family," Deion Sanders said last week. "You rarely see one without the other. You rarely see one of those guys anywhere. You see three or four of them together at all times." Only four of the 10 full-time assistant coaches from last year's team are listed in the same coaching roles as last year, after five coaches left for jobs at other schools and one coach changed positions. Quote, "The staff is a much better staff," Deion Sanders said on the pregame show this week. "It's a much more understanding staff that's more relatable to these young men as well." Saturday will be a dress rehearsal for them, too, especially on defense under new defensive coordinator Robert Livingston, who previously served as defensive backs coach for the NFL's Cincinnati Bengals. Livingston lost McClain but gained several newcomers, including Oklahoma State transfer cornerback DJ McKinney and former LSU lineman Quincy Wiggins, both of whom have 3 years of college eligibility remaining. They are expected to play in a format Saturday that will feature the first team offense against the second team defense and the first team defense against the second team offense. Quote, "I'm excited to feel that atmosphere," Livingston told reporters this week. "I'm excited to see what it's like to be here under the mountains and kind of everything you took the job for." After the game, the transfer portal remains open until the end of the month. More players could come and go before the Colorado roster is formed in time for the season opener August 29th at home against North Dakota State.
Here's some commentary or opinion from the sports section. Sky need to reach higher to keep up in WNBA. The WNBA's past and future are colliding in the Chicago Sky. Training camp hasn't even started, and already several versions of Angel Reese and Camila Cardoso's new jerseys are sold out on the WNBA's team's website. Full and half season ticket packages are nearly gone, and tickets for the regular season home opener are selling fast on StubHub. Yet when Reese had her first news conference Wednesday, it was at the rec center in a suburban strip mall that doubles as the Sky's, quote, practice facility. The Las Vegas Aces and Seattle Storm have massive state-of-the-art facilities all to themselves. The Sky has a Taco Vita a few doors down. "Being able to change things going into the right direction is really important," Reese said. "I think we're at a great point right now. Us continuing to do what we do and perform not just off the court but on the court as well, I think it's going to continue to grow." The Sky have been talking for a while now about a new practice facility and talking, even winning the championship in 2021 couldn't move the team to get shovels in the ground. Unsurprisingly, almost every player from that title team has since left Chicago, almost all of them going to teams that have shown a commitment to providing appropriate resources for professional athletes. The WNBA and NWSL deserve to be considered as major professional leagues in this country. For that to happen, however, every one of their franchises has to be pulling its weight, or better yet, punching above it. Major League Baseball is established enough it can tolerate the Chicago White Sox being a laughingstock without them dragging everyone else down. The WNBA isn't there yet, not yet anyway. In recent Cardoso, the Sky have two transformational players, fierce competitors in the SEC. Reese and Cardoso paired together will give Chicago one of the W's most foreboding front courts. They could be just as formidable off the court. Reese is already a bona fide star and could own Chicago as Michael Jordan and the 1985 Bears did. Cardoso is quieter but has already shown the ability to endear herself to her new town, mentioning it has the best pizzas when asked on draft night what she knew of Chicago. "We both know our impact here," Reese said. "We want to bring those championships here and continue that legacy that's already been started here." Reese and Cardoso can help accelerate the WNBA's growth. It's on the Chicago Sky not to hold them back.
And now let's hop over to the Life section. Greer adds them to 1970s Foxy Brown. Usually, the only intruders Pam Greer has to worry about are the horses who saunter into her Colorado ranch house uninvited. Quote, "I've got to get them out before they poop," says the longtime actress and 1970s film icon. "They feel comfortable walking in and going to sleep. Hey, Mom, how you doing?" In her new horror series, Greer, 74, faces something far more supernatural. Them, the Scare, now streaming on Amazon Prime Video, centers on Dawn, played by Deborah Iorinde, an LAPD homicide detective in the 1991 aftermath of the Rodney King beating, pursuing a serial killer who leaves gruesome crime scenes. Greer plays Dawn's mom, Athena, who takes care of her daughter and grandson, played by Joshua J. Williams, harbors a deep, dark secret and has terrifying visions, including a monstrous washing machine around the house that may or may not be real. Quote, "This is not the sex symbol of old," says Greer, who gained fame in the blaxploitation era and became a pop culture powerhouse with films like 1974's Foxy Brown. Now, quote, "I know what it's like to take care of people who can no longer take care of themselves anymore and are ashamed and give up that strength to vulnerability." Greer has a history of scary projects dating back to 1973's Scream Blackula Scream, which includes the 2001 Snoop Dogg movie Bones and last year's Pet Sematary Bloodlines. Quote, "Not everyone can handle horror. They don't like to be scared," she says. "I don't like going into a dark room I've never been into." What scares Greer most? Using ancestry sites like 23andMe. "Oh, I have 99 cousins? Great." For the second season of his anthology series, Them creator Little Marvin sought out Greer to play Athena. Quote, "When I read the script first time, I'm scared. My hands are sweating. Woof. Now I know why folks drink," she recalls. "He felt I wasn't numb from all of the events in my life that could make people run into a padded room, never come out, and be weighted by medication." But Greer pulled it off by bringing her real self to the role, so much so that it involved crying, anxiety, and nosebleeds. "I'm not layers of calluses on my emotions. I'm raw. I'm still there. It made me feel. Yay, I haven't given up." In 1991, when The Scare is set, Greer wasn't living in lavish L.A. Instead, she called Colorado home, taking care of her family, and she still loves that lifestyle. "I have trucks. I have dirt. I could name 10 tractor companies," she says. "I don't roll out of bed and get to go to work. I come from a long distance of really enjoying what I'm doing. I step off the plane. I walk into the office in character." But the LAPD of the past was ill-informed and very dangerous, she says. In the late 90s, Greer was starring in the Showtime comedy Lynx and stayed in L.A. for 9 months while filming on the Paramount lot. She left for work one morning at 4 a.m. and was stopped by an officer on Melrose Avenue, told to get out of her car, and interrogated about what she was doing at that time of day. "They didn't believe me, and if I made a false move, I probably would not be here," Greer recalls. "I'm never late for work, but I wanted to survive. That scared me. And if it's happening to me, a woman with rollers in her hair going to work at 4 a.m., then a whole lot of folks are going through something." Greer recently optioned her 2010 memoir, Foxy, My Life in Three Acts, and her life story is being developed as a TV series with Village Roadshow Pictures. One of the aspects it will touch on is the origins of Foxy Brown, which celebrated its 50th anniversary on April 5th. Foxy, a woman who poses as a prostitute to infiltrate a criminal syndicate after her undercover agent boyfriend is murdered, has been a touchstone for decades. But in action films like Foxy and Coffee a year earlier, she surprised people as an up-and-coming actress who spent her childhood in Colorado and Wyoming hunting, fishing, and studying karate and aikido. It took 3 to 4 years to prepare a patriarchal society to see a woman in a man's position, traditional martial arts leadership, standing up, talking back, Greer says. She also admits that she got a lot of my foxiness from the women around her, especially her aunt. I was just doing what they were thinking. I didn't create the wheel. As a kid, quote, I was a dork and skinny. My kneecaps were bigger than my legs. I wasn't attractive. I didn't attract boys or anything. So in her early 20s, when she was cast in Foxy, her first thought was, I don't think they're going to watch. And lo and behold, they did watch for 50 years.
Bon Jovi doc honest about band Sambora. After 40 years, 130 million albums sold, thousands of stadiums filled, and many a musical fad dodged, Bon Jovi is still standing. The anchors of some of rock's most durable anthems, You Give Love a Bad Name, Bad Medicine, It's My Life, Living on a Prayer, Wanted Dead or Alive, as well as new entry Legendary from the band's upcoming Forever album, long ago achieved icon status. Bon Jovi's history, from playing grimy clubs on the Jersey Shore to their zenith in the 80s, to decades more of musical stylistic experimentation and sold-out tours, is presented with unflinching honesty in Thank You, Goodnight, The Bon Jovi Story. The 4-episode documentary, totaling nearly 5 hours, debuts Friday on Hulu. Directed by Gautam Chopra, Man in the Arena, Tom Brady, The Greatness Code, the film traverses the era of ripped jean shorts and the frosted tipped mane sported by Bon Jovi in his 20s, to the agonizing vocal issues and gray hair shag that arrived in middle age. Along with Bon Jovi, 62, fellow original members drummer Tico Torres and keyboardist David Bryan chime in frequently, as does guitarist Ricky Sambora. Richie Sambora, who abruptly departed Bon Jovi in 2013, and finally offers somewhat of an explanation. The band's original bassist, Alec John Such, who left the group in 1994 and died in June 2022, is eulogized. I think people might be surprised to find out how far back your relationship goes with Bruce Springsteen. Obviously, Bruce is the Mount Rushmore of rock in rock and roll and the king of rock and roll in New Jersey. Look, the E Street Band and Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes made the impossible seem possible. You were going to run into them in a bar, which is important because the posters on my wall of Led Zeppelin and Queen and Mott the Hoople, you weren't going to meet those guys on the Jersey Shore. And now you've given up the secret of your long drives with Bruce in New Jersey. We were neighbors. Our kids went to school together. We spent a lot of private time together but didn't need to tell the world. As we've grown older, I'm vocal about it because I didn't feel the need to hide something that was true. I've just known the guy for 45 years, and he happens to be like a big brother.
Zendaya says it was kind of scary making Challengers. In Zendaya's erotic drama Challengers, tennis is the new sex. The movie in theaters Friday follows a messy love triangle between bright young tennis stars all chasing a very specific kind of high, that rare moment when two players fully lock into the game, entwined in a romantic tango of sorts on the court. It's an intoxicating feeling described by her Wonderkin character, Tashi Duncan. But while making the movie, Zendaya never reached such nirvana. I never got that good, she humbly says with a laugh, speaking by phone earlier this week. Since filming wrapped in 2022, I haven't really picked up a racket. I went once just to hit a few balls and see if I could still do it. And you know what? I wasn't too bad. I thought it would have all just gone out the window, but there was a little something there. Taking place over 13 years, Challengers tracks Tashi as she falls in and out of relationships with Patrick, played by Josh O'Connor, and Art, played by Mike Faist, best friends competing for her attention on and off the court. The sweaty, sultry film has made headlines for its three-way kiss and so-called villain Tashi, a tennis prodigy who turns to coaching after she's sidelined by a career-ending injury in college. The character is a world-class manipulator and motivator as she pits the red-blooded, well-to-do guys against each other. But her passion for tennis and insatiable desire to win stems from her modest background. For Tashi, there is no other thing to fall back on, Zendaya says. Her parents can't afford what the boys can. There's not that luxury of just knowing you're going to be all right either way. Also, she's never given herself a moment to grieve the effects the injury has had on her life. She immediately just sucks it up and moves on. And I think that's an experience a lot of women feel, and a lot of black women as well. Not having the time or the space to just feel, and having to present to the world as very strong all the time. Zendaya, 27, was already attached to the project when producer Amy Pascal sent the script to director Luca Guadagnino, call me by your name, who was drawn to this idea of the game of love and eroticism portrayed through the game of tennis, he says. The Italian filmmaker has been long fascinated by Zendaya's career, from her start on Disney Channel's Shake It Up to her two-time Emmy-winning role on HBO's Euphoria. He likens her to an old Hollywood star whose, quote, sheer personality and power can command the gaze of millions of people. She has a natural gift combined with a sense of gracefulness and hard work. She's a producer on Challengers 2, which added a level of fun, Guadagnino says. Zendaya has this curiosity and commitment to the art of filmmaking. She's invested in the process beyond merely acting in it. Zendaya, who has roughly a decade of producing credits under her belt, says she felt, quote, free to suggest and bring in ideas. I got lucky that Luca is extremely collaborative, so whether I had a producer title or not, he would be open to working together. You don't always get that. For the actress, it was also about championing original stories at a time when non-franchise films struggle to break through if they aren't named Barbie or Oppenheimer. The R-rated mid-budget Challengers comes from first-time screenwriter Justin Kuritsky's husband of Past Lives director Celine Song, and it's a test of Zendaya's star power after her appearances in the Dune and Spider-Man film series. Quote, we need to make more movies like this, Zendaya says. It's kind of scary because this is an original screenplay, and those can be difficult to get people out to see. I hope that we can continue to have more variety in Hollywood and get people engaged with different kinds of films. Challengers has already drawn feverish attention online for its fashion, from Tashi's sapphire party dress to her I Told Ya slogan tee, inspired by a shirt John F. Kennedy Jr. wore in the 1990s. Although Zendaya herself is a style icon, she gives full credit to the movie's costume designer, Jonathan Anderson. These characters are intertwined through clothes, Zendaya says. There's a lot of t-shirts that start with me and end with Josh's character, or the boys share t-shirts sometimes. There's this ever-present thing of them being connected while they're with the other person. Zendaya and her longtime stylist, Law Roach, have always loved telling stories through fashion, with jaw-dropping looks that frequently reflect her current projects. Promoting Challengers, the dynamic duo has been leaning into so-called tennis core, polo dresses, neutral colors, and stilettos spiked through tennis balls. We've been having a lot of fun with tennis looks, Zendaya says, but it's also important to us that there's a storytelling element, that it just doesn't feel like glitz and glamour the whole time. So we decided to pay tribute to iconic figures. Last week, she and Roach recreated a 1998 Vogue shoot by tennis legends Venus and Serena Williams, in which she wears a near-identical black-and-white gown with beaded braids. Afterward, Law got a nice message from Venus, Zendaya says. They also collaborated with sports brand On for a replica of tennis whites worn by Althea Gibson, the first black player to compete at Wimbledon in 1951. That was a special look, just paying homage to her work as a black woman, Zendaya says. You are listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Tina Casagrande and Doreen Yelton have been reading from the USA Today. This broadcast is generously supported by The Forest at Duke. They can be reached at 800-474-0258. We thank them for their contribution. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired and is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast by visiting our website, NC Reading Service.